Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. The Sound of Many Waters, a year-long exploration of our need to care for our environment, and how together we can help restore the world. Indigenous people around the world celebrate the UN General Assembly's long-awaited approval of a declaration on their rights. And Father Jim Brand encourages us to take good care of God's creation, something we can all do in many small and different ways. It was about a year ago when my interest in the environment and the urgency of climate change pushed me into dedicating more and more time and more programs to the issue. Lately, it's become difficult to pick out and highlight all the times Pope Benedict XVI has appealed for the safeguard of creation and underlined the urgency of taking action. That's because more and more often, he's expressing his belief that it's up to us, now, to do something to stop causing damage to the natural world. He spoke about it earlier this month in his address to an encounter of youth in Loreto.
Alle nuove generazioni ha affidato il futuro del pianeta, in cui sono evidenti segni.
The future of the planet, he said, is entrusted to the new generations, in which one can see the signs of a development that has not always respected the delicate balances of nature.
Occorre adottare scelte coraggiose.
Before it's too late, he continued, we need to adopt courageous choices which can recreate a strong alliance between man and the earth. The Pope said that what is needed is to invert those trends that risk creating irreversible, degrading situations. And all around the world, more and more parishes and church-based organizations are taking up the challenge of involving and engaging the faithful in initiatives and events aimed at raising awareness and taking action in the safeguard of creation. Sound of Many Waters, that takes place at Clifton Cathedral in Bristol, England, is one such event. I spoke to the woman who inspired it. She's Mary Colwell, a Clifton Cathedral parishioner, BBC natural history producer, and passionate ecological campaigner.
The Sound of Many Waters is a year of events based in Clifton that have a local focus but also look to the bigger, wider world. And what we're trying to do over this year is look at different aspects of the human relationship with the natural world. And so it's a way of exploring, not just in a very worthy way, but in a fun way, and in a family way, and in a contemplative way, how people in the natural world actually fit together. So it's a year of exploration.
This coming Saturday, that's Saturday the 29th of September, is actually the day the event will be launched. I asked Mary to tell me exactly what the day programme foresees, and who's invited to participate.
On Saturday, there will be a special launch of just for 45 minutes, where I'll show a film that I've made, a short film, which has bishops from around the world intercut with beautiful footage from the Natural History Unit, and also from leading scientists around the world, commenting on how important it is that science and religion get together, and that we can together create a completely dynamic duo that will be able to save the world. We can't do it on our own. We have to do it together. And so on that film, there are people like Bishop Wensky from America, Bishop Chris Toohey from Australia, Cardinal O'Brien from Scotland. We have on there the head of WWF International, chief scientist for the World Bank, E.O. Wilson, the renowned biologist. And I've cut together comments from all those people with very beautiful natural history footage to give an overall picture of the bigness of this, of the importance, the way that the big thinkers of the world, both scientific and religious, are coming to the same conclusion, that it's only together, through our understanding of how the world works and through our spiritual insight, can we come up with an answer.
Now, you mentioned leaders of all kinds who have to come together.
Pope Benedict XVI has expressed his concern for the environment more and more insistently in the past few months. In his words, he's called for a strengthened alliance between mankind and the environment in the promotion of common good. Now, are, do you think, religious leaders beginning to speak out on the dramatic climate change crisis, and how important is it that they do so?
I don't think it's important. I think it's absolutely vital that they do so. Because if we just take a route that seems obvious through science or through technology or through very practical ways of doing things, I don't think that we'll come up with the right answers. I think that's only part of the story. I think what has to come is the religious insight that you can only get through a contact with something much greater than yourself. And I think through that humility, through what good religion gives to people, is a sense of real humility, of our own smallness, I think, in the face of this great vast universe. Without that sense of humility, without that sense of wisdom and listening and taking time to think and praying about it, I don't think that we'll be able to apply what we've got through science and technology to the best advantage. I think it's absolutely essential that we do the two together, because we won't solve this on our own. We have to solve this in conjunction with the scientists, but also in conjunction with God.
But Mary, more specifically, what is this special contribution the church and its leaders have to give?
I think that it has special contribution on quite a few levels, actually. One of them is something which is not talked about at the moment. Everybody is in an absolute panic and in a rush. And if we don't do something now, it's all going to go down the pan. And I think what religion brings is a sense of time. A sense of that there is, you know, more haste, less speed, isn't there, is the old saying. And in a way, that's a very religious insight. That unless we take time to pray about, unless we take time to think it through, unless we take time to work out what's going on, nothing will happen well. And I think religion puts the brakes on a bit, not in terms of the urgency that we need to do something, but the best way to do it, and that's never in a panic. We never do things well if you do it quickly and thoughtlessly. The second thing that religion brings is a sense of joy, and that despite the problems, this world is absolutely amazing, is absolutely fantastic. And the sense of joy and celebration and reveling in the wonder of the natural world is very much a part of what religious tradition can bring. And that's really important for the human spirit, to have that sense of joy and wonder. I think it also brings, I think Catholicism does this beautifully, is bring a sense of forgiveness, that there is something to be sorry about here. There is a lot that the human race has done, which has caused irreparable damage, serious damage, destruction of species and habitat. As we all know, from the Catholic point of view, that requires forgiveness. And that's then an incredibly empowering thing, because you can then move forward. It's very hard to move forward if you're feeling terribly guilty all the time. And I think that religion and Catholicism understands that beautifully. And the secular world at the moment has no mechanism for allowing people to actually say, we're sorry. And I think that's a very human thing that it brings. It also brings one other thing, which is vitally important, I think. Take away climate change, take away extinction of species, take away habitat destruction, take away all the problems, we still have to work out our relationship to the natural world. Even if there was no problem out there, we would have to know and understand who we are in relationship to the rest of the living creation. And I think that's what religion helps us to focus on. The fact is that we have a relationship that is apart from problems. And we need to refocus on that relationship and work out what that relationship is. If we get that right, the problems will go away.
But religion and the church don't always have the same pace, do they? The church, after all, is propelled by men. Don't you think, I asked Mary, that it's taken the church a rather long time to bring the environmental issue to the forefront?
It has, in one way. I mean, I think John Paul spoke very beautifully about it. Way back, even in the 70s, he was saying things, which is when the environmental movement really started to kick in, and he was listening back then. I agree it's taken a long time to get to this point. It's taken a long time for concrete action. I mean, the Catholic Earth Care Australia were the first Catholic environmental organisation, and they formed 5 years ago. It is slow, but but to be honest, I don't think the Catholic Church ever does anything particularly quickly. And the fact that it has over the last few years really started now, and over the last few months and weeks, started to say big things that will help really focus people's minds, is amazing. And I don't think, to be honest, I don't want to worry about should it have happened before. I'm just so glad that it's happening now. And I think it is in time. And I think the church knows that there's so much it can do and should do. It's not a matter of an add-on. It's not like, oh, the church ought to look at this as an extra. I think there's a whole realisation that this is actually central to who we are and what we do.
Mary, you've often had the experience of giving talks in parish environments, in church environments. How do the faithful react to your words of warning and of encouragement?
Really wonderfully. I mean, I think that's the one thing. I couldn't sleep last night. I was lying in bed thinking, am I hopeful about the future? And, you know, I really, really am. And I think it's because, not because of popes and bishops and church institutions, but because of people. I think this two-legged mammal that's walking around on this earth has caused a lot of problems, for sure. But we're also made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore capable of the most amazing things. And all the people that I've met on my talks, and particularly recently when I've been doing joint talks with Bishop Chris Toohey, the sense of people grabbing this and understanding it and wanting to take it forward and being so open to it all is what gives you the hope. If, you know, it will happen because people are people. It will do. And I think people have the potential to be absolutely great in this, and I don't doubt that we'll do it.
One last thing about Sound of Many Waters. As you were saying, it's going to be a year-long event. Who can participate, and how do you hope it will contribute to Christian engagement?
Anybody can participate, anybody of any age, any background, anywhere they live, any faith, it really doesn't matter. Anybody can come and take part in the events that we've got set up through the year, and everybody is welcome. What will it contribute? I think we'll have done our job if we keep the reminder that this change has to come from inside people's hearts. It can't be imposed from the outside by government. I mean, it can be helped to keep us, but it can't be, you know, taxes and laws and regulations will only go so far. The change will only happen if it comes from people's hearts. And the Sound of Many Waters keeps that there, keeps that constant reminder to people that this is about a change of heart and about a new way of looking at the world. Then we'll put a big tick in that box. It's there as a kind of hope, I think, and a hope and a reminder that this is a very spiritual thing that we're trying to do, and that it's always in people's minds. And if it is in people's minds for a year, well, maybe it'll stay there for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. But if we've done that, then I'll be incredibly pleased.
In conclusion, with its capacity to draw on Catholic teachings, insights and networks, Sound of Many Waters wants to engage as many people it can to help restore the world and fill it with the sound of many waters flowing together.
I'd hope what we do in Clifton might make other people think, wherever they are around the world, that they can do something the same. Maybe not the same, but, you know, whatever suits them in their circumstances. And that everything is worth doing. And I hope they do that too.
Yes, climate change is a threat to the whole of humanity, to all the living creatures in the world, and to their habitats. Amongst the most threatened are tribes of indigenous people who depend on hunting and foraging for their subsistence, and whose natural habitats must remain intact for them to be able to survive. But climate change is not the only thing undermining their very survival. In fact, despite some progress over the last decade, indigenous peoples around the world continue to live in hardship and danger due to the failure of states to uphold their fundamental human rights. After many years of debate and negotiation, September the 13th, 2007, was a day of celebration for Indigenous peoples as the UN General Assembly finally approved the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by an overwhelming majority. I got on the phone to Survival International, a worldwide organisation that supports tribal peoples and helps them uphold their rights, because I knew they would be celebrating too. I spoke to Carly Mercier and began by asking her exactly how the organisation operates.
We work on behalf of tribal peoples, helping them to achieve their human rights, helping them especially to gain land rights and to be in control of their own destinies. And we do that through campaigning, lobbying governments, organising supporters to do letter writing campaigns and various other things.
Now, September saw the UN General Assembly's approval of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. How did you at Survival International receive this news?
Well, we were thrilled by that, definitely. There have been discussions about this declaration for more than 20 years. At times it felt like perhaps it was never going to be passed. But no, it was a fantastic day because this declaration sets out the minimum standards, basically, for governments and their behaviour towards Indigenous peoples. So it was very good news indeed that it was passed.
In fact, I was really surprised. I read that the vote came after 22 years of debate and negotiation and that some countries, including the US and Australia, voted against it. Now, what kind of interests can go against such a declaration?
Well, they claimed... I'll just point out they were in the minority. There was only four governments that voted against and 143 that voted in favour. Those four governments claimed that... various things, basically, that they thought certain aspects of the declaration were too wide-ranging. They were worried that Indigenous people might try and claim their whole countries back. And basically, it's a tragedy that they weren't able to see that this was an aspirational document. This is a standard, a benchmark, whereby all governments should be trying to achieve minimum standards for Indigenous peoples. And the fact that those so-called developed westernised democracies didn't feel able to vote in favour is quite depressing.
In fact, the event does underscore a problem that's often out of the limelight, and that's the abuse and disrespect with which Indigenous peoples around the world are treated. Can you give us an example of a people who have suffered from lack of respect for their rights and why?
A tribe that Survival works particularly closely with is the Bushmen of the Central Kalahari Game Reserve in Botswana, and they were evicted from their lands by the Botswana government. Basically, they say the reason that they wanted to move them is so that they could develop them. They feel they would be more civilized and developed if they could be settled outside the game reserve, where they can be given access to schools and to hospitals and so on. But actually, the opposite effect has happened. They've been moved from their land, and because they've got no access to their land now, they've become completely dependent on the government. There have been all sorts of health issues, such as HIV, AIDS and tuberculosis, that weren't an issue when they were living on their own land. They're losing their culture. There's a lot of problem with alcoholism and violence and so on. And this is all because of a misguided attempt to civilise and develop people who don't wish that to happen to them and wish to be in control of their own development and organise it at a pace that suits them from a position of strength. That means from their own land.
If I'm not mistaken, this particular people in Botswana was also evicted because the government thought that their land was good mining area for diamonds.
That's right. I mean, Survival and the Bushmen believe that the real reason they were evicted because of diamonds. The government's given many reasons for the evictions, and the one that they're sticking by at the moment is because they wanted to develop the Bushmen, that they were doing it for their own good. But as I've explained, it's not actually helped the Bushmen in any way.
Now, I think most of our listeners, at least, will agree that Indigenous peoples do have rights to ownership of their land and to live as they wish. I also think Indigenous peoples have a lot to offer the rest of the world. You've mentioned cultural heritage and knowledge, probably, of medicinal plants. Am I right?
Well, definitely. I mean, besides the fact that we want to recognise their rights as individuals and as groups, simply because it's right to recognise people's human rights, they also, there's a huge benefit to everyone from having their cultures surviving. As you mentioned, they've got knowledge of plants and medicines that we don't necessarily know about yet. Even things like their languages are really important to everybody because they can teach us all kinds of things about how languages evolve and about how the human mind works and things like that. So there's many different reasons why it's important that these people should be able to be given a fair chance. But obviously the most important reason is that they're humans and they have human rights like everybody else.
I read on your website that there's still a number of uncontacted tribes in the world. It's quite amazing, this. Where are these tribes and what do they risk if they're violated?
Indeed, there's about 100, at least 100 uncontacted tribes around the world that we know of. A lot of them are in Latin America, some in Papua also, and some on the Andaman Islands in the Indian Ocean. Basically, what they risk if they're contacted is decimation, because a really high rate of tribal peoples die after first contact, so because they basically don't have immunity to things like the common cold, and sort of up to 90% of a tribe may actually die if a contact is handled in the wrong way and people go in and try and meet them and talk to them. So yeah, they risk losing everything, basically.
Carly, just finally turning back to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, what are the main points that were brought up? What are their main rights?
Well, their main rights are to self-determination, which means basically that they have a right to determine their own social and political and cultural status. They've got rights to their land and territories. They've got the right not to be thrown off those lands and territories. And they've got the right to be treated as equals, basically, as individuals and also as Indigenous groups.
Sounds like really basic rights, isn't it?
Basically, right. And all those rights really exist anyway for individuals. But the great thing about this declaration is it's saying that Indigenous peoples, as peoples, have these rights as collectives and should be able to operate these rights as groups. Say, for example, a really basic thing like should be able to have education in their own language and should be able to determine what that education would consist of.
There's so much talk nowadays about the preservation of biodiversity. One would think that this should apply to the human sector as well.
I guess so, yes. And also, I mean, the interesting thing is that there's a link between those things, because where tribal people have their land rights recognised and are able to live on that land and hunt and gather, the biodiversity, of course, is also preserved for everybody. So that's a real benefit to recognising tribal people's rights especially.
Carly, is there any particular hope you have?
Well, I hope that this declaration will be something along the lines of the UN Declaration on Human Rights that was passed about 60 years ago. Although we don't necessarily have a situation now where all countries always recognise and uphold all of the rights in that declaration, we've definitely seen huge progress over the last 60 years in regards to individual human rights. And I would like to see the same thing happen with Indigenous people's rights. I'd like to see this document be used as a thing that all governments should aspire to, and hopefully that will have real benefits over the years to come for Indigenous and tribal peoples.
And in theme with this programme, dedicated to creation and to all of its inhabitants, Father Jim Brand, Spiritual Director at the Pontifical Beda College, explains that each and every one of us can and must work to do our share in caring for Mother Earth.
Hello, it's Father Jim. God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put us to care for it. Gardening is one of my great hobbies. Spend a lot of time on my knees. Do all the plants at the college in Rome from seeds and cuttings. I love to touch my Mother Earth. There's a beautiful song, chapter 5 of the prophecy of Isaiah, about Israel being a vineyard. Let me sing to my friend the song of his love for his vineyard. My friend had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug the soil, cleared it of stones, and planted choice vines in it. And in the middle he built a tower. He dug a press there too. But he expected it to yield grapes, but sour grapes were all that it gave. So I ask you to judge between my vineyard and me. What could I have done for my vineyard that I haven't done? I expected it to yield grapes. Why did it yield sour grapes instead? Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I'll take away its hedge for it to be grazed on, and knock down its wall for it to be trampled on. I'll lay it waste, unpruned, undug, overgrown by the brown, the thorn. I will command the clouds to rain no rain on it. How disappointing for a gardener, when we do all we can. Now Israel is littered with stones. and to make it fertile it's taken centuries. First of all picking up the stones, then trying to water it, and then give it nourishment, and then planting. By the way, a vine needs good pruning, otherwise it will kill itself if it tried to bud on all its shoots. And our Lord said, if he's the vine and we're the branches, we need pruning, not to hurt us, but to produce more fruit. We've got roses in the garden. It's kind to a rose to prune it so that it doesn't exhaust itself. And we're all so gifted, we couldn't possibly flourish on all our gifts. One lifetime wouldn't be enough. In fact, if I didn't believe in something better, I'd like to believe in reincarnation. I'd love to come back for more. Be somebody else, do something else, fall in love deeper, learn more, visit other places. Because one lifetime isn't really enough, it seems, for life to the full. So before any politician went green, God is green. He planted a garden and there he asked us to look after it. And when you think of the violent history this earth has had, geology and astronomy are one of my hobbies, and when you think in the 4,500,000 years the history of the earth, oh, it had been crushed and remoulded so many times, and it's taken all those millions of years for the earth to put down her larder. Larder of oil. And the sad thing is that the brothers and sisters of the earth, some have got there before the others and are raiding the larder. And eventually many of Mother Earth's resources will be used up. And many of our brothers and sisters won't even know that there was a larder. You think how precarious Mother Earth is. I believe the rivers are now in danger from pollution and other things. Some people travel miles and talk about global warming. From the very beginning, we have to remember that Mother Earth is the mother of all the living. And we need to share Mother's larder. Otherwise, we'd be in great trouble with the Lord, who gave us this earth for all to care for it. One of the rules of gardening is you only get out of Mother Earth what you put into it. So there is a theology of compost still to be written. That all our bits and pieces, instead of just being wasted, somehow need to be turned back to refresh Mother Earth, that poor thing can be exhausted just because some greedy people got there first. Ezekiel was talking about this. When people arrived at an oasis, first there, first served, they were all butting each other out with their rumps, muddying the waters for those who come after them. The whole earth is a commonwealth. Let's be careful not to squander the wealth, but to make sure that what wealth there is common. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.